This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, it's harder than you think, writing sex scenes in speculative fiction.
And this week, I would like to point out that I did not come up with the title.
Hey, it's callback to the episode we did a couple of years ago, which was, it's not as hard as you think. Actually, I think it is, in fact, harder than you think. But normally, a pun of that magnitude would, in fact, be the work of Miss M.E. Vaughan. So...
It's true. But I wanted you to take the credit this time.
The blame, you mean?
Sure, whatever.
Right, so, well, it's been a couple of years since we talked about this, and obviously we've both written a lot more since talking about writing sex scenes, and I thought we might have more things to think about. But what really sparked the episode was Jules got annoyed on Twitter by something she saw and thought it would be worth discussing.
Ah, yes. Good old Jules saw something on Twitter and got annoyed.
You'll notice I don't ever get engaged in Twitter battles or anything. I just save it up and turn it into material for a podcast.
Yeah, it's... I just wait for the days I get messages like, I just saw something on Twitter. Of course you did.
We've had some good episodes out of it, I would like to say.
Don't get me wrong, like, Twitter has provided us with some brilliant material, so thank you, Twitter, yeah. And the stuff that appears on your dashboard in particular has provided us with some very good points, so I'm not at all surprised that that we're getting something from Twitter again today, that bountiful tree.
Dumpster fire. No, I actually really enjoy engaging on Twitter because of it being fast-paced and because of there being lots of variety. So just to do it credit. And it's only every so often I'll see something and I'll think, you what? And I'll look at the entire thread. But I won't reply because I just don't see the value in getting into fights on social media with people just because they have a different opinion to me. Or I try not to anyway. I will get to the thing I saw that really sparked me off in a moment, but it's all to do with terminology. Before we get into that, let's do... I haven't actually gone back and re-listened to our episode, but I think these are points that we've made. However, I also think there are also points that are worth revisiting with the unoccluded eye of 2 years later. So, for example, we'll just jump right into it and keep it fairly organic, but it's the idea that sex scenes should drive the plot or reveal something about the character if you don't want them to be gratuitous. Now, generally speaking, I would say I agree with that. It's the same as a scene of violence. It should be there for a reason. It shouldn't really be there just as titillation. However, this is where I make my little amendment from 2 years later. It very much depends on what genre you're writing in as well. You might be writing not even erotica, but a steamy romance whereby, you know, the sex and the conflict that the sex causes is in fact the point. And the actual scenes themselves don't bring a lot to the table other than the fact that that's providing what your readers want.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily moving the plot on, and they may not necessarily be showing very much about the characters individually, but they are there for a reason. So I'm taking a less aggressive stance on that one, I think, for me.
Yeah, and I think I always took a slightly less aggressive stance to it anyway, but I do agree with you that I've never been one for gratuitous scenes, but I do like to be indulged. And certainly think that, yeah, if you go into a novel and you are expecting something, then every page doesn't need to be an intense character development or anything like that. you go into that novel, you want some steamy sex, you'd probably be a little bit disappointed if you got to the end and you didn't have any of it.
Yeah.
That is what, you know, that is a selling point for it. Nothing wrong with that if that's the kind of book that you are writing. But as you say, I would then point out that those sex scenes do have a purpose. So they're not necessarily gratuitous. They've got a reason.
Yeah.
Even if that reason is just titillation.
Yeah, you know, your readers want to read some sexy times, and there's nothing wrong with that. There genuinely isn't. I suppose I'm thinking of we're not discussing the sort of lower end grade, basically literary porn that you get flooded with on Amazon. I guess you can do. A little bit around there comes up with some really, really interesting titles like Taken by the Gay Rainbow Tank and things like that. Which,
yes.
I've not read it, but that sounds really painful. But no doubt that's somebody's kink right there. Okay, so fair enough. Oh, well, that went... That jumped on that carousel really, really quickly, didn't it?
We're barely into the episode and we're already there.
Let's assume that the tone is going to be low for this one.
Yeah.
I suppose the thing is, if you have good characterisation and a decent setup, then readers are quite happy to read scenes whereby not too much happens, as long as you're showing them more of the characters they already love. You're not going to capture readers who don't feel engaged with the characters, but the readers who really love the characters are kind of like, they're fine. It's the whole, you know, the two movie adaptation of the Deathly Hallows, whereby I can see it's a money spinner, but I would have been perfectly happy with a third movie just showing Harry and Hermione wandering around the moors trying to avoid Voldemort, you know, because I already love the characters, so I'm fine, I'm happy, I'm entertained. But someone who is engaged as that, and it is not part of that fan service, is going to get annoyed. So it's very much your mileage will vary thing, I think.
Yeah.
Having said that, I did get a bit annoyed in A Court of Wings and Ruin when Rhysand seems to be permanently erect. You know?
I was waiting.
I'm sorry, but he does.
I was like, how long until we get to A Court of Thorns and Roses?
8 minutes, 47 seconds. Yeah, that's how long.
If even that.
No, I don't necessarily want to bash that, believe it or not. I genuinely don't, because I know a lot of people really enjoyed those sex scenes. So that's fine. we'll come on to the whole new adult, young adult thing a bit later.
Yeah.
Other things, I think... associated with the point we've just made, if you're going to write graphic violence and then you're going to have a situation whereby you would expect sex to happen, and I don't mean rape, because rape is a violent act, it's nothing to do with actual sex really. That comes under graphic violence. So if you're going to have, you know, genuine consensual sex happening and then you close the door on it, but you've got really, really gory violence going on in other parts of the book, most readers are going to feel that that's unbalanced.
Yeah.
And they're going to feel quite cheated, because if they've gone into it sort of like, oh, I'm really, really up for some violence and sex, etc., and you just deliver on one end, they're kind of like, hmm. That's clearly a case of the author's not comfortable writing that.
Yes. Seem to be actually a little bit of a thing, which is that there seems to be more comfort with writing horrific violence than actual intimate sex.
That's a real problem as well, don't you think? That
I do think so. Yeah, considering one is actually, you know, a part of a lot of people's lives and should be discussed, and you know, it is relatively normal, and the other isn't and shouldn't be.
Yeah, or that people are comfortable writing what is graphic sexual assault, but you want to show them doing a tender sex scene, or a consensual sex scene that's a bit sort of a bit risque, shall we say.
Yeah.
There's an inordinate amount of shame attached to it, and I think that's a real problem, something that should be addressed ultimately.
Yeah. And I will point out that weirdly enough as well, shame that comes in with it is anything that's to do with female pleasure. Or anything which isn't directly kind of geared toward the male experience. So in terms of the kind of the sex that we will be shown, you know, penetrative sex, you know, penetrative sex between a man and a woman, fine. Him going her, probably not so much. Certainly, sex between two guys, very unlikely. Sex between two girls, it's going to be completely written for a male gaze rather than anything to do with women.
Yeah.
And if it's anything that kind of goes beyond that sort of very basic penetrative male-female sex, anything which kind of looks the experience or the sensuality for a woman, it kind of becomes gratuitous. That's the kind of the way that it's shown, in that no, that's a little bit too much. That's too much. That's we can show someone having their eye gouged out, but a woman having an orgasm is a little bit much.
Yeah, no sex, please. We're British. That's just not cricket. I think there's another aspect to it as well, which is when you have that sort of thing, and you've got an author who includes violence and includes sex and does actually finally get to a sex scene. The point of that sex scene is nearly always penetrative sex, and then after that is kind of like, well, the fireworks coming down now, and there's no point ever revisiting that.
Yeah,
for a lot of them, and it's a case of, well, we've got from point A to point B there, and we don't need to go any further, and let's ignore the fact that there's an entire sort of other 20 other letters in the alphabet where they could go. You know, there's a whole new world if you want to follow it in that direction.
And as much as you want, you can look down on A Court of Thorns and Roses. They didn't do that in A Court of Thorns and Roses. They explored that alphabet. They really explored that alphabet.
They explored up to F, maybe, in my opinion. No, I think the problem with that was ultimately, for me, was structure. It wasn't really an issue with the sex scenes. I know some people were scandalised, but it's like some people are saying, we should classify it as erotica. And I'm like, have you actually read any erotica? You finally actually use the word penis in erotica. You don't have to include lots and lots of sex scenes. And certainly, if I've put a sex scene in something, it's because that actually moved the plot forward. That was a sticking... Oh, God. Okay, that was a sticking point for the characters. Laugh.
Okay. Listen, look, there's nothing you can say which just can't be misconstrued in some way or another, okay? So we're just going to have to accept that now.
And that was a way that they obviously overcame a particular obstacle. It said something about their relationship. It doesn't mean that's always going to be how it is, because some of the other books that I am writing and I'm planning on writing, they will have sex scenes in, but they're not necessarily going to be all about, you know, two basically just out of their teenagers really falling in love, and that's not going to be the point of it all the time, which I suppose brings me to the other point, which is that sex does not have to mean love in a scene. It can be shorthand for it, but it doesn't have to.
Yeah.
Two characters who have sex might just end up being very good friends, or maybe they have a friends with benefits situation and they're fine with it, or maybe they're not exclusive to each other.
Yeah.
I think it's too limiting to say, well, you know, these two characters have to fall in love, or one of them has to do something really bad to the other one to excuse the fact that they've had sex and they're not together. And that's something that really bothers me.
Or also this idea that if two people have had sex, and they're not together, it's because one of them is the guy usually is dastardly.
Yes.
He's taken something from the female character, and she now feels like she's been led astray. Which is kind of, you know, that does happen, and that it is fair enough to sort of have that story. But yeah, you're right in that's what we see, is that sex is meant to be love. Which you get that particularly in YA. And on the one side, it's, you know, it's a message of don't just jump. Make sure you're ready. And a good way to make sure you're ready is to make sure that you're doing it with someone you trust and someone, you know, who's going to take care of you. Now that is, you know, that will equate to make sure it's someone you absolutely love. Yeah. But, you know, sex is a... Sex is an act. It's a very intimate act, but it is just a thing that you do. And it will have different meanings for different people. It's very revealing. And you might suddenly find that, you know, you're having sex with someone and go, actually, we're not right for each other. And that's okay.
Yeah.
And certainly I think that it also unintentionally, in trying to basically, you know, give this message of you should, you know, be doing this kind of thing with someone you like, it's given this message of you should absolutely wait and not indulge in anything like that, and to indulge in this kind of thing with someone who you don't completely love is wrong.
Yeah.
Which is ultimately damaging.
I think, yeah, I agree that it's a really mixed message, particularly in young adult terms. Are books that counteract it a little bit. There's a book that came out last year called Jack of Hearts. I'm really sorry, I can't remember the author's name, but the publisher was kind enough to send me a finished copy. And the main character is a gay male character, and mm-hmm. he starts running an online sex advice column, which is hilarious. But people are just getting in touch with him anonymously through the school newsletter
mm-hmm.
and asking his advice, because the way he sees it, he's not ready to settle down in a relationship. There's lots of people he likes, and it's not a case of I'll sleep with you once and I'll never be with you again.
But
it's also a case of I'm nearly 18 years old. I'm not ready to settle down yet. I don't want to do that until my mid-20s at the absolute earliest. In the meantime, I don't see why I can't have a lot of fun as long as it's all consenting and everybody's on board and knows the score. So he's really open about it, and he's really open that, you know, sex for him, it's for pleasure and for connecting with people, and it's a fun thing to do. And sort of like the book promotion was, let's have sex and forget each other's names, which I think was taking it a little bit too far in the sense that that's not really how the book reads. But I thought at least that was a relatively healthy, you know, sex can just be for fun type message. So there are books out there, but that book got such a massive backlash from exactly the like coterie of pearl clutchers you'd expect.
Yeah.
And not just because it was talking about sex as just being a fun act that you did not have to have any strings attached to it as long as there was respect and consent, but because it was talking very specifically about gay sex.
And
even worse, apparently, a gay man giving straight people advice on their sex lives. And it's just a case of, okay, at this point, I've got nothing on you guys, you know? This is a banging my head against the wall moment. So just sit over there and complain. No doubt it'll make you happy kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's an incredibly sex-positive book. It's really, really good. I highly recommend that one.
Yeah. And to be honest, actually, I do think that we, you know, you can say, oh, we shouldn't be exposing young people to sex. Actually, young people will...
There's YouTube out there.
Look for it. Yeah. They will look for it, and they will find things which are not great. They will find a way, because they, you know, you are thinking about those things when you're that age. And if that isn't readily available to you, you will find it in places which are not meant for you, which you're meant to, like a lot of porn, you need to go into it with a level of understanding. This is not actually how reality works. This is a fantasy which is being put on screen, and that's not how sex works really at all. And kind of being exposed to that sort of thing, and to imagery which is often quite violent in one way or another, as your education in sex, and I'm not talking about sex education, learning about the how it works. That's your first sort of experience with sex is via this thing which is really not meant for you at all.
Yeah.
That's going to be really damaging. So actually having very positive and very open kind of talk about sex, I'm not talking about very graphic sex scenes in YA books, but talking about, and not just talking about it as a special experience, which for some people it will be, and I completely respect that, but also talking about it as a social thing, or just a thing you do for fun. Something you tried out with someone and it wasn't quite right then, but actually it's been just as special with somebody else. Looking at it from all different angles, but most importantly, talking about it as it is. I think that's really important.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Okay, which brings us on to my next point, which is that a sex scene does not need to have any sexual activity going on it in order to qualify as being a sex scene.
And this is the part where you explain how a sex scene can be sexy without actually any sex happening.
Yeah, so generally a sex scene is about, I suppose, the emotional landscape of the character in a lot of ways. It doesn't have to be. You can have sex scenes that are literally just about the physical act, and you can have sex scenes that are far more about the character journey, and they do actually move the plot along, but there isn't actually any sex happening. So, as an example, and minor spoiler for I Rule the Night, when M comes back to university from visiting Aunt Mary in Yorkshire, she can't see Kieran that night, so she decides she's going to practice with Lucas. Only when she gets to the practice room, she finds him playing his violin for another girl, and it sort of strikes her in that moment that she is actually at least physically attracted to him.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a shocker for her. She's very demisexual, so to suddenly realise that there is another bloke that she is actually quite physically attracted to is a bit of a shock.
Yeah.
And she even makes the point of... And there's a moment of jealousy as well, the sort of sexual jealousy you'd expect over a prospective romantic partner. It's the sense that, well, I've never wanted him, but I now feel slightly possessive because he's playing with this other girl and I feel like I've walked in on him in bed with someone else.
Yeah.
There's no sex in that, obviously. And there's no kissing or touching or anything like that. But there is that heightened emotional state and that awareness of herself physically and him physically.
Yeah, absolutely. Which I think is one of the main components that you do have in a, you know, a sex scene. Also, you know, there's the role of the act as well, the role of music within not just the, you know, the book, but within the series, and the relationship, her relationship with Lucas is entirely tied to music, and their first real kind of romantic coming together when he first, again, small spoilers, but when he first kisses her, they've just been singing together.
Yeah.
So there's already this great relationship between music and physical intimacy and emotional intimacy between them. So the music really does carry that physical intimacy in that he's doing something incredible that he's done with her, which has been incredibly private and incredibly a very, you know, in very highly charged situations. And he's doing it with somebody else.
Yes.
And she's walked in on it. So you're absolutely right that it is actually a sex scene. But there is that they've got all of their clothes on.
Yeah, there's no touching at all. And there's a minor argument between the two of them afterwards, and they end up settling it by sort of playing violin against each other, and that sort of carries on the sex scene, if you like.
It does, yeah, absolutely. It's now I'm going to reanalyze everything.
But it's a trick that I've, and I think in fairness, you can call it a trick that I have utilized at first without really realizing that's what I was doing. So think about the first book when M turns up thinking she's going to see Aunt Mary, and actually it's Kieran sort of standing in his pajama bottoms in the doorway, being very physically present, and that's a sort of shock moment for her.
Yeah.
That was done sort of instinctually, but it's kind of generally the reader kind of feels that sort of shock of awareness as well. And it sort of follows through the books, I think. So technically you could argue that I've actually written a lot of sex scenes, they just don't have any sex in them.
I think you're right. But I think that they do really come to the forefront with Lucas.
Yeah.
Probably because he does actually want that from her. He wants a relationship from her and she can't really give it. But he also represents a whole other, you know, side, which is the dead, you know, which is her power. And the fact that there is, you know, there's this very intense relationship that's happening with her power as well. And we're getting very metaphysical here. We get into the roles of symbolism and all that jazz. But, you know, there's this huge sense of passion. And I think also, you know, the fact that you're kind of touching a few gothic tropes there, and the gothic is of unto itself romance and horror. You know, it ties it all in very, very nicely. But I do think you're right that, you know, there's a lot of sex that's happening. There's a lot of, you know, eye sex that's happening a lot as well. But also symbolically, a lot of what they're doing, and the fact that M has to periodically kind of bear her soul in different ways, is akin to the actual physical act of. I'm trying to think of instances where I might have accidentally done it now.
I don't know. See, I think the thing was, once I realised what I was doing, I was thinking, actually, I think this kind of works for a young adult series. So I kept doing it.
Yeah.
But ultimately, when I got to the fourth book, I couldn't cheat any longer, in the sense of there's only so long you can string your readers along promising something and not deliver. I mean, teasing is fine, but after a certain point, they're going to get really annoyed.
Yeah.
And that was why an awful lot of people got annoyed with Breaking Dawn in the Twilight series, which was when Bella and Edward get married. We won't get into it, but the whole idea, the fact that when they finally get into a sexual encounter together, the doors are very firmly shut on us. We get a very graphic birth scene, a very graphic birth scene, but we don't get invited into the bedroom. And a lot of people felt that that was a cop-out.
Yeah.
Particularly since the whole issue of sex, marriage and purity was very much brought up as well by Edward, it's worth pointing out. But
yeah, you're absolutely right. I also think that you, in terms of Unveiled, you know, it wasn't just that you would be cheating your readers. I think at that point, if you'd prevented your characters from from having sex, they would have jumped out of the pages.
Throttled me. Yes.
For God's sake, please.
Yeah, and that's fair. And that is one where it was a case of, no, that needed to happen to move the plot along, because they got themselves into a conversational and communication impasse.
Yeah.
And there are more than verbal ways of communicating. so that might not have been the best reason to do it under, but it certainly wasn't the worst reason either.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. Another question of genre and character. So, if you are going to include sex, that's great, fine. But they're a really detailed 4-page blowjob probably doesn't belong in a book that's intended for 14-year-olds.
No, I would tend to agree with that, that very much.
Yeah, but that obviously doesn't mean you can't mention sex.
No. Or even blowjobs, technically.
Yeah.
But yeah, it really does depend on the story or writing, and certainly, yeah, that go into should be appropriate for the age group that you are, and the audience in general that you are aiming toward.
Yeah, I mean, the reverse of the whole closed door situation is when, you know, the doors are kind of open all the time and nobody can explain why characters are having sex, because it's just a case of, this is random, this has happened randomly. We've all seen TV series where the writers have clearly gone, we didn't expect it to go on for 6 seasons and we don't know what to do with these characters, let's put them into bed together, and there's been no build-up.
Yeah.
And it's just a case of, where the hell did that come from?
Yeah, sex for shock value.
I mean, I still maintain that the Cordelia Connor Angel love triangle in Angel was not thought out and not something that they chose to write in, although they have excellent writers, so they managed to almost pull it off. But the whole Cordelia having sex with Angel's son when she'd previously been in love with Angel was just really bizarre, as in disturbingly bizarre. And yeah, okay, later they explain it by saying she was possessed, etc., etc. But at the time it was a case of, is this because the actress is pregnant and you need a way to get from point A to point F, and this is a shortcut because you know you can't film with her much longer? And that's kind of how it read to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I suppose there are things like, I've mentioned Dark Angel before. There's a lot of angels going on here. They're not actual angels. Dark Angel's about the genetically engineered mutants who are super soldiers, and the main character, Max, and the bloke whose name I didn't bother to remember. He's the Fiora Eyes only guy, the hacker. They have they sort of dance around each other for the first season. I'm like, okay, yeah, I can see you doing a slow burn, that's fine. Second season, there's no real reason to keep them apart, except that the bad guys get hold of Max and give her this virus that only affects him, so they can't physically touch each other. And that's a case of, That felt contrary. You're really trying to hold on to that, aren't you?
It makes me think about Pushing Daisies.
I don't think I've seen that.
It's a TV series. I'm sure you've heard of it, about this guy who basically, if he touches something, he can bring it back to life.
Yeah.
And then if he touches it again, it will die.
Ah.
But if he brings something back to life and doesn't put it and doesn't let it die again within 30 seconds, something else of equivalence within a certain distance will die instead.
Right.
So, for instance, he discovers this power and his mother accidentally dies when he's a child. He brings her back to life and in doing so kills his neighbor's father. And then when his mother leans down to kiss him goodnight, she dies as well. So what happens is that he starts working with a police detective to help figure out murder case.
Yeah.
The victim back to life, but they only have 30 seconds to kind of find out who killed them before they have to put them back to death again.
Yeah.
And he encounters the girl that he loved, that he's always been in love with. He brings her back and he can't bear to let her die. So they live together and they're very clearly in love with each other, but they can't touch each other because if they do, she'll die.
Yeah.
So they kiss through cling film and stuff like that, and he's a pie maker. And it's very odd, and it's incredibly colourful considering how grim it is. And that's a series which is, despite, you know, the fact that it's very, it's not childish, but it's kind of very innocent and jolly, despite everything, does actually have a lot of sex scenes without any kind of sex happening, because you have these two characters who are very clearly into one another, and want to physically be together, but they can't be. But they're not necessarily upset by that. They just find ways around it to be intimate instead.
Yeah, I don't know. Perhaps it works better when you actually watch it, but that just sounds bizarre.
It is an incredibly bizarre series, and I never finished it. It wasn't for me. But it's certainly an amusing idea.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's look at the whole labelling issue. I understand that when it comes to sex scenes in books and the frequency of sex scenes in books, that readers' mileage can vary, and that's fine. Okay, I don't necessarily want to read something that where sex is a substitution for plot any more than I want to read where violence is substitution for plot. I want a good plot with both of those elements, hopefully.
Yeah.
But where I have an issue is it's largely in the romance genre, but it's starting to creep over into other genres. And it's the fact that romance without sex, closed door romance effectively, is being labelled as clean.
Yeah.
And that was the thing that annoyed me on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm with you with that, because, guys, it's really, really time that we stopped thinking of sex as dirty.
Yeah. That for a start. And the fact that I get, you know, I really get that there are people who want to read romance that is perhaps based around their own religious practices and beliefs as well, and that's fine, but I really hate the way that that goes hand in hand with all love must be exclusive and all love must be heterosexual and therefore it's clean and we don't see it. It's fine to want it to be private and off the page or closed door or hinted at or whatever. If that's your preference, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But can we please not use the word clean to describe that?
Yeah.
Because obviously, as Madeline has said, the inference is that the reverse is filthy.
Yeah, which is damaging and obvious. And really kind of calls to this very peculiar relationship we have with sex that I don't understand, because pretty much everybody at some point in their life does it. Not everybody, of course. You know, there are people who don't have sex, don't want to have sex, choose not to have sex. Absolutely fine. But considering that our entire species has relied upon us having sex forever.
Yeah, nobody's learned how to just divide cells by themselves yet.
Yeah, not yet, you know, it's coming, it's happening. But no, sex is all around us constantly. It's a huge part of our lives. It is the reason every one of us is alive and we have an incredibly funny relationship with it, all things considered. And the other thing is that we seem to have this idea that we've always been this prudish about sex, that we've always been this you know, kind of keep it hidden away, when that's not the case. And we can pretty much blame the Victorians.
Yeah, you can. And you know, the mythology comes along, things like men got turned on by table legs, that's why tablecloths were invented, which we know is bollocks. It's a very entertaining story and I find it very funny, but it's not true.
Yeah.
And things like the Victorians didn't know what the clitoris was. Well, actually, yes, they did. Probably some of them didn't. Probably a very specific proportion of the population, in fact, didn't.
Yeah.
The fact that one person isn't able to find it doesn't mean that an entire period of history had no idea what it was for. So this is a discussion Madeline and I had the other day, was the fact that in medieval era Europe, certainly around the 1400s, they were actually very open about sex, and their humour was very toilet humour based. There was nothing funnier than the idea of farting in someone's face, literally.
quoth. Sorry.
Tee-hee, quod she, and cleft the window too. Yeah, you know, that was the pinnacle, the absolute pinnacle of humour. I'm not necessarily saying I want to see a return to those days, but they were also really open about sex. They were very private about love and affection, but they were very open about sex. A lot of the time, because people didn't tend to live private lives there. They lived in big households or they lived with huge families. Children would have seen sex between adults from a very early age. In big households where they all bedded down in the hall at night, yes, it would be dark, but people would have been aware that a few men were popping over to the women's side and vice versa. They would have all been aware when the Lord was making his conjugal visits to his wife, etc. So, you know, people would have been well aware of what was going on, and they were very open about it. And it's just, we assume that, oh, well, you know, they didn't have any idea what was going on back then. That's such rubbish.
Yeah,
it really is. There are sex manuals dating back to the 1400s that were written by monks, which is, you know, slightly hilarious. In fairness, monks could marry in the 1400s, so, you know, chastity wasn't something that was expected of male clergy. And these sex manuals are pretty explicit about sort of, you know, if you want a good chance of producing children during your sexual encounter, then you need to kind of make a woman orgasm first.
Yeah, so that's nice.
but phrased in a much more hilarious manner than that, which I won't repeat right now. So yeah, this idea that historically that we've always been really sort of straight-jacketed about the whole thing is just ridiculous.
Yeah, and that also that it was only ever about having children in the past, and not about actually enjoying yourself. Now, in a previous episode, you know, Jules, you mentioned the fact that, you know, contraception exists and has existed for a very, very long time. Not always 100% successful, but, you know, it did exist, which meant that people were having sex for fun, not just to continue having children. It was something which was enjoyed, and it wasn't something which was continuously seen as a chore either. I'm sure for some people it was, and I'm sure there are definitely circumstances where, you know, there were married women who definitely did not want to be having sex, but that doesn't mean that that was the case. And certainly the problem is that we're taking a lot of this standard from the nobility, completely ignoring the fact that you had all of these, you know, the rest of the world who weren't marrying out of a sense of duty or for anything like that, but could marry for love, for instance, could be attracted to one another and could be having sex and enjoying themselves.
And they weren't necessarily waiting until marriage. That is a relatively recent convention, particularly among the lower classes.
Yeah.
Quite often they would wait to see if a child was likely before they decided to get hitched. So having little affairs before you got married, if you were part of the common folk, wasn't unusual. Yes, they did. The nobles certainly did tend to stable their daughters away so they couldn't get impregnated, so to speak. But they knew what was going on. I think there were quite a few noble households where actually it was a case of, no, they were perfectly, they were enjoying what they were doing. The church had a very intense stance on procreation being the only reason for sexual encounter, that all sex should be geared towards procreation, and any sexual act that wasn't in fact designed to result in children, so oral sex, mutual masturbation, anal sex, anything like that, was put under the label of sodomy. Sodomy didn't just mean sort of taking it up the arse kind of thing. It meant anything that wouldn't result in a child. But people, you know, this was unenforceable. The church did not manage to enforce this very well. Just as the church didn't preside over marriages back then, the church wasn't considered to have anything to do with a marriage, really. You only had a bishop or somebody officiate over your wedding if you were very important.
Like a king.
Like a king, or you know, a very, very wealthy noble. Otherwise, you just, two people said, yeah, I want to be married, and that was it. They might have a little party with their family, but nobody officiated, and it was still, you know, that was the common law marriage. So, you know, the church never managed to really completely enforce its sexual practices, and it is the same even with sort of same-sex couples. People knew it was going on, and as long as, I think, honestly, you would be, if there was like a plague or the blight or something, you would fall into the same category as, unfortunately, Jews and women who lived on their own, spoke their minds and things did, whereby they'd be looking for people to blame. But otherwise, most people were kind of like, okay, you like the same gender as you, that's weird, but okay, as long as you can contribute to the community, we don't care.
Yeah.
It was far less of an issue than people make it out to be, unless, of course, you're important. If you're a king and you're indulging that sort of behaviour and not fathering a child as well, then people had a real issue with that.
Looking at you, Richard.
But yeah, again, you could have got away with it as long as you were discreet. Awarding someone a dukedom and lots of wealth and, you know, taking money from the common people to lavish gifts on your favourites was not very subtle.
Very subtle at all.
So, we've gone off piste here. But it does bug me when you have historical novels and they're sort of, even the bodice rippers, and it's kind of like, she yielded to him kind of thing. It's like, are you kidding me? They believed women needed to have regular sex back then to stop them turning into complete maniacs. Seriously, it was a case of, no, your husbandly duty is to make sure your wife is relatively well satisfied fairly regularly.
I mean, even in the Victorian period, they thought that one of the cures for hysteria was an orgasm. And certainly, I think if you're feeling particularly anxious because you're not allowed to vote, and you're considered a second-class citizen, having an orgasm every now and again probably would, you know, ease it a little bit. Not really, but, you know.
Well, there were doctors who taught husbands how to do that as well. And I'm just thinking that must have been the most awkward doctor's appointment ever.
Awkward. For everybody involved.
So I don't like this assumption that, you know, everybody knows that. And it's a case of, do they though? Or was this kind of like, this was the best bit of mythology and everybody's indulged in lazy thinking since then?
Yeah.
It sort of explains our attitude to things when you start to get onto the whole, the clean romance thing. The sweet romance. And the thing is, I have a scene you don't see an awful lot happening, but bear in mind I have psychics in my books, so M kind of wipes out an entire street during, because all that power's gotta go somewhere. And it's a case of, yeah, that's embarrassing and it's funny, and a lot of people have written to me and said that was so funny, that light bulb scene, and I'm always embarrassed, and I very nearly didn't include it in the book, but Madeline made me.
Me.
But no, it was funny. But at the same time, I'd still say that was kind of sweet.
I would tend to agree with you. That's why I wanted you to include it. I thought it was funny, and I also thought that it brought up a really nice part to sex, which is that things happen sometimes when you're having sex that make you laugh, or you get interrupted, or it's not always 100%, you know.
It's just a bit embarrassing.
Yeah, like, sex objectively is incredibly weird. Yeah. You look at it, it's very weird. There's you know, it's and I think it's actually kind of nice to remember that sex isn't always the, you know, that this very steamy 100%, you know,
everything's perfectly choreographed.
The woman is weightless at the same time, you both need the same thing at the same time. Like, sex isn't always like that, and that's okay. I just thought it was really nice to have this scene where you have these two, you know, these two young adults who are having sex and things haven't gone exactly according to plan. And it is a little bit embarrassing, but it is funny, ultimately. And it's okay that they get that there's a slightly embarrassing incident, because ultimately they've had fun. No harm has been done. And they both kind of laugh it off and can just, you know, get on with their lives.
Yeah,
I just thought that was really nice and important.
And it's the fact that they're even in sort of the extremis of embarrassment afterwards and everything, and the fact that one of them is being incredibly smug, in fairness, they're both completely accepting of it.
Yeah.
Which, when you consider how weird M really is.
Very weird.
That's a very particular sort of person, isn't it? You can sort of kind of go, okay, you've blown up all the electrical implements kind of thing, but fine.
Yeah, I just thought it was really nice. I thought I liked it. And I would say that it was quite sweet. And also a really healthy depiction of a sexually active relationship.
I'm not going to say it's like my raison d'etre with my writing is when I need to include a sex scene, it's always going to be like that, because there are many, many different reasons but that people might decide to indulge. But in that particular relationship, that made sense.
Yeah.
I want to talk very briefly about we've mentioned it before, but I hate this trope so much, I'm coming back to it, is the alpha male trope.
Yeah.
I genuinely get why some people really love it. And it's just, it turns up in paranormal romance, and now it's turning up in lots of others. It's turning up in so-called sweet, clean romance now as well. And I'm thinking, you have no problem with the bloke basically being a bully and overpowering your independent woman.
Yeah.
Just as long as you don't see them have sex. And I'm like, can we talk about the really unhealthy relationship dynamic there, which apparently is absolutely fine.
Yeah. I think the big problem comes with the fact that because we don't actually see them having sex, we also don't see the communication that goes along with sex.
Yeah.
You know, of the boundaries being set, of, you know, of an understanding of what works between people. And instead, kind of what we're given is this kind of hint toward the fact that this is going to be very, you know, steamy sex. And for some people, that, you know, that's exactly what they want. They kind of want to be dominated. So you have this character who basically says, that's what's happening, that's what I'm going to do, that's what I'm going to give you. But actually, he's just unpleasant throughout, domineering in a way, in areas that he wouldn't be domineering in. And you don't have that talk, you don't have that communication. Now, obviously, it's fiction, so there's, you know, it's not safe, I guess, is the word, you know, for a reader who wants to be able to explore these ideas. It's very safe to be able to do that through fiction without ever actually having to put the situation. But you can read about that kind of experience instead. But at the same time, really, I agree with you. I find it very unsettling because you don't have those lines drawn, those boundaries drawn, which which exist in a healthy relationship, even if that relationship dynamic is, you know, a dominant with, you know, involves a dominant personality. But if it's healthy, there will be lines drawn, there will be communication, there will be an understanding. And you don't get that in a lot of these books.
I think that's what gets me. Aside from the fact it's a misappropriation of the word alpha by people who actually don't understand how wolf packs act and work. Separate issue. My bugbear. Moving on. There is also, as you say, it's the dynamic between characters there, and it's nearly always portrayed in quite an unhealthy way. And even when you had sex in, which at least shows them being a bit tender with each other, usually after a real sort of plate-shattering episode.
Yeah.
which, as fun as it is to read, also leaves me a bit sort of like, not every sex scene has to be Klingon sex kind of thing. Moving on. It's the fact that they'll show quite an unhealthy dynamic between characters who are apparently, by and large, having quite vanilla type sex, if they do show sex at all, or if they don't show it and it's clean and sweet, etc., inverted commas, then it just looks really, really bad. It's like one person really dominating somebody else with no consent and no prearranged agreement.
Yeah.
And I've read things like Cushiel's Dart, whereby it's pretty BDSM heavy, honestly. And partly that's because she is a courtesan and, you know, she's an anquisette. She's somebody who achieves sublime pleasure through pain.
Mm-hmm.
And that is her job. But it was an indentured job initially. So the whole idea of an imbalanced sexual relationship is really nuanced and well sort of covered, well explored. When she ultimately makes her mark, she wins her freedom, and she still continues to work as an anquisette because she's like literally the only one pricked by Cushiel's dart, the only one with the sign that she is the chosen of the god kind of thing.
Yeah.
She makes a lot of money doing it. There are a lot of people willing to pay top brass for that. But in all her encounters, and it does go into a fair bit of detail, you never get the impression, bar one occasion, which is a specific plot point, that there is anything less than respect going on. The boundaries are set at the beginning. It's written into a contract, even. And then after that, everything goes, and it's well explained. Whereas I feel where you just have an alpha male character sort of shoving a female against the wall and kissing her in order to make her reserve melt, as it were, which I've actually seen in a so-called like sweet romance, I find that weird and kind of a bit rapey, because there's no seeking of consent even.
Yeah, and certainly if you're writing, if you're trying to say it's meant to be a sweet romance, you know, if you're advertising it as some sort of somehow morally superior or cleaner or stuff like that, then actually, what message are you sending here? What are you actually saying with it? Because again, there is nothing wrong with books which involve that typical alpha male character. Again, not really my jam. I don't really read a lot of that kind of stuff. I don't really read a lot of romance at all. I prefer fantasy, and if it's got romance in it, then great. But there's nothing wrong with that, and there's nothing wrong with enjoying it. You know, go wild, go hog wild. Again, unfortunate terminology.
But it was a bit, yeah.
You know, do whatever you want. Fine, absolutely. But again, to the writers and the people who are making these labels, hold on a minute, guys. What are you actually saying? And what are you, you know, how dare you kind of put this forward, you know, under some morally superior veneer, and then actually include some things which don't really feel vanilla, to be honest.
No, quite frankly, there isn't any excuse for not... You don't have to be bald about it. You don't necessarily have to have an on-page discussion, but there's no excuse for not putting in something about consent as well. We're not in the 1950s anymore. We're not in the state whereby a woman having sex out of wedlock or whatever or even in wedlock, has to show her sort of succumbing reluctantly to her passions, or, you know, basically being ravished because otherwise her virtue is gone. We're not there anymore.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to not be looking at the issue of consent around it.
Yeah, and also something to remember if you're writing fantasy and all that jazz, or even historical, when are you writing it? And are you using Victorian ideals? Or, you know, is it actually, you know, correct to, you know, to put those things and to have those conversations of consent? Is it, this is the bit that it gets, he's like, you did genuinely believe that that's what life was like. If you're writing a fantasy novel that's got dragons and magic, then a woman consenting to having sex cannot be the most fantastical thing that's happening.
Yeah.
You can't be like, no, it's not believable. Like, shut up.
It's like, right, so you can have dragons and manticores and evil gods, but apparently that's going too far. Okay, last point, and that is looking at different types of sex. Obviously, I'm talking about pan, bi, gay. But I'm also looking at non-exclusive. I think part of the problem with the coding where sex equals love and love equals sex, etc., is the fact that it needs to be exclusive, otherwise no one will believe it. And
yeah.
Yeah, it can be a form of pair bonding, but it can also be a form of group bonding. Now, I'm not actually talking about group sex or anything, but I'm like, can we acknowledge that there's a growing group of people who, you know, there's lots of polyamorous groups out there as well. There's lots of people who are together and that's with their life partner, but they don't have exclusive sexual rights to each other. They've agreed
yeah.
not to. Everybody's consenting. And I'm not saying everybody always has to include that in their books, but I think people should bear it in mind. Just like if they should bear in mind that if they write asexual characters, asexual might just mean they don't get the damn you're hot moment. It doesn't necessarily mean that they don't enjoy sex once they get going with someone they really like.
Yeah.
So it's looking at the broad spectrum and not trying to pigeonhole people too much.
Yeah. It also, you know, basically also not just conforming to the standards that we think of things, which is that, for instance, if you are bisexual, then you are, you know, very sexually active, because you can have a bisexual who's also asexual.
Yep.
Okay. And sexuality doesn't actually necessarily have to tie in with sex at all. And you can also have these sex scenes which don't actually involve that physical intimacy as well. You know, so there's lots of ways of doing it. So having, you know, having a gay character doesn't necessarily mean that they are 100% down all the time to go with other, you know, gay characters. Or that if you have two gay characters, automatically they will just one another. Because that's not really how things work. Yeah, so bearing these things in mind, I do think you're right, it is important.
Okay, I'm going to finish off with... See, I can't even say finish off now without thinking of it as euphemistic. I'm balls deep, so I'm going to finish. By looking at some of the contenders for the 2018 Bad Sex Awards, because some of these show you really how not to do it. Okay, so here is an example. There's two or three maximum. This one is from The Hunt for Handsclap by Major Victor Cornwall and Major Arthur St. John Trevelyan, who perhaps should reconsider their choices. Empty my tanks, I begged breathlessly, as once more she began drawing me deep inside her pleasure cave, her vaginal ratchet moving in concertina-like waves, slowly chugging my organ as a boa constrictor swallows its prey.
Okay. Look, before we get into this, I'm just going to say that realistically, there's no way to write sex which isn't going to be funny to somebody.
Absolutely.
That, like, as I've said, sex as an act is incredibly funny if you look at it objectively.
Yep.
So writing about is always going to lead to hilarity, because there's no substitute you can use which is not going to be funny, and there's no way you can use the real words without it also being funny. Okay, so we're gonna go straight into that sex is always going to be kind of funny when it's written down or read aloud or anything like that. Okay, with that disclaimer, what
yeah
what?
We've said before that animal imagery is generally a bit of a no-no when you're writing a sex scene, and I stand by that opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And also Pleasure Cave?
Pleasure Cave. Pleasure Cave is, yeah. The empty my tanks bit also was...
That's a bit sort of like, what are you doing? Are you parking a car or getting it on? Seriously, dude, make your mind up. Okay, this is one I have a particular issue with. It's a slightly longer excerpt. It's from Killing Commendatore by Haruki Murakami. And generally, I would say I love his writing. It's beautiful and lyrical, but I'm like, I don't know. Was he on LSD with this one? Possibly. Okay. My ejaculation was violent and repeated. Again and again, semen poured from me, overflowing her vagina, turning the sheets sticky. There was nothing I could do to make it stop. If it continued, I worried, I would be completely emptied out. Yuzu slept deeply through it all without making a sound, her breathing even. Her sex, though, had contracted around mine and would not let go, as if it had an unshakable will of its own and was determined to wring every last drop from my body.
Okay, so that's rape.
Yeah.
Right there.
And there's the whole issue with her body actually being complicit in her own rape. Now, admittedly, that's out of context. Perhaps she said before that, I don't mind if you do it to me while I'm asleep. I'll give you complete consent to do that anytime you like, whatever.
Yeah.
But that's still very... It just taken from the excerpt, that's just... What the fuck? Seriously?
Yeah. I also find it... I don't know. It... Sleeping peacefully throughout that, it just feels like, even if you did somehow manage to stay asleep, you'd be feeling things regardless. You'd at least be dreaming them.
Yeah, I mean, unless she took some Valium or something, but...
Yeah, but it's the fact that, you know, her body reacts.
It's kind of like, oh yeah, it was joining me even though she wasn't mentally that... Honestly, who wants to have sex with someone who's asleep?
Yeah.
That's just... Anyway, there's all kinds of wrong there, and it wasn't a great depiction anyway.
No.
Final one. This is all a very stream of consciousness. This is the one who actually won the Bad Sex Award. It's Katerina by James Frey. And in case you're wondering, the entire book is basically garbage.
Okay.
I think he's a great literary writer, probably, from what other people have said. But I don't know what he was doing with this. This is basically background. It's semi-autobiographical and deals with the author sort of hot-footing around France, having sexual encounters.
Right.
Okay. I'm hard and deep inside her, fucking her on the bathroom sink, her tight little black dress still on her thong on the floor, my pants at my knees, our eyes locked, our hearts and souls and bodies locked. Come inside me, come inside me, come inside me. Blinding, breathless, shaking, overwhelming, exploding, white God, I come inside of my cock, throbbing, we're both moaning, eyes, hearts, souls, bodies, one, white God, come, come, come. I close my eyes, let out my breath. Come.
Okay.
I read that how it was punctuated.
Right. Okay, well, I can kind of understand what he was trying to do there. The kind of the whole sort of evaporation of thought in a moment of ecstasy. Yeah. I can understand kind of what's happening there. I'm still deeply uncomfortable.
Yes. I'm kind of surprised that got past an editor, to be honest.
I don't know. I just don't know. As I've said, to be honest, I kind of get a little bit uncomfortable with any kind of sex scenes which are written like this, written in this way. I can see
it's very
what he was
male
trying
point
to do
of view for all of them, isn't it?
Yeah, very male point of view, but also it's just. I think the real problem for me is that it was entirely centered on the very physical aspect of what was happening.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just prefer to see more out of it than just that physical side of things. You don't really get very much from who of what the characters are. Of who the characters are. Well, no, we're not going down that road, okay? We are not going down that road. I do not need the nightmares. But we don't get, you know, any real sense of who the character, you know, and any form of intimacy between them other than the very physical description of what is happening. At the very least, he didn't use animal imagery.
Yeah.
So well, that's good.
He didn't say like an enameled pepper mill when referring to her private parts, which is, you know, something one of the others did.
Yes. Yeah, it's always animals and food, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we would advise that you don't aim your sex scenes like that, basically.
That being said, sorry, I don't know what happened there. That being said, whatever you're writing, you know, as long as you're happy with it.
Yeah, ultimately, it's your mileage may vary.
And depending what you're writing. Again, I can totally understand how some people might read that and go, yeah, fine, I can see exactly what's happening. It feels very literary fiction, that's what it feels like, and I'm not fond of literary fiction in general. So it feels very much like it fits into that little box, which I don't really touch anyway. So fine, if that's your thing, then go for it. The world is your oyster. But yeah, certainly I kind of tend to stand by the rules, which is minimize any mentions of animals and mentions of food. Yes. I'm sure there are ways you can do it right, but
there's that awful one I sent you, I found it on Twitter, didn't I, where the bloke was likening having sex to someone turning a large bowl of macaroni and cheese with a spoon.
Oh my god, yes!
And I couldn't believe I'd read it, so because I couldn't believe I'd read it, I had to send it to Madeline, because this is what I do. I find weird shit like that, and it's like, you have to see this.
Yeah, I was made to witness. Yeah, that was very uncomfortable. Oh, why did you remind me?
I just remembered, sorry.
Oh, dearie me. Okay. I think we've come to the end of this.
Thankfully, we have come to the end of this.
Oh, now we can't even say that word.
Yeah, thanks, James Fraser. James Fraser, rather.
Dearie me. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe you've got one for us this week.
I have. I want to recommend the anthology Hell's Empire, which is edited by John Linwood Grant. Full disclosure, I do actually have a story in this anthology, but I'm recommending it on the strength of the fact that it's a fantastic anthology by its own merit. All the authors who were involved were basically given the outline that it's set in Victorian Britain in the later stages of the Empire, and instead of War of the Worlds where the Martians arrive and start invading, it's the demonic invasion of Britain, and it sort of covers anything around the British Isles, so there's all sorts of settings. The stories are kind of interlinked, and looking at everything from sort of like the border country in Wales, which on the edge of Wales rather, which is where mine was set, to a big battle down in sort of the Southampton area, to various fights and things in London, and you've got the Yorkshire Moors, and it's sort of all over Britain, and it's Victorian Britain rising up against the demon invasion and, you know, all the hordes of hell. And it's just a really, really entertaining, fun anthology that with lots of different styles, and yet somehow we managed to all hit it pitch perfect, I think. And I think that was John Linwood Grant's excellent editing, bringing us all together and just turning all these little songs into this amazing symphony.
Yeah. And I'd like to point out that only Jules could describe the rapture as a fun little...
It's a fun little read.
It's a fun little... At the end of the world.
Also, also, anyone who saw me on Twitter talk, you know, musing about whether or not to keep the demonic sheep, I did keep the demonic sheep, and that is in that story if you want to read it. It's a story called Yan Tan Tethra.
I assume it's set in Wales.
Border country.
Ah, so border country, okay.
Between England and Wales.
Fantastic. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening and bearing with us as we get through this very uncomfortable subject. And we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.